Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, April 19th, 2022. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson apologizing in the House of Commons, appearing there for the first time since being fined for illegally attending parties 2 years ago in violation of COVID-19 lockdowns. But the Prime Minister rejecting calls from opposition leaders and some from his own party to resign. We'll hear from them and talk about the political situation in Britain with a reporter for The Atlantic based in London. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov confirming that a new phase in the war in Ukraine has begun, a battle for the eastern part of the country. Lavrov also saying that Russia takes the use of tactical nuclear weapons off the table when it comes to this conflict. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris announcing the U.S. will no longer conduct any anti-satellite missile tests, saying debris from a test by Russia recently put other communication satellites and astronauts in danger. And U.S. House Republicans suggesting that if they get control of the House after the November elections, they may impose term limits for committee leaders on the Democratic side, like the limits they have now for their own party. We'll get the latest on this controversial idea from reporter Mike Lillis from The Hill. Reuters, Dateline London. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will face a vote later this week on whether he should be investigated over claims he misled Parliament by repeatedly insisting that he did not breach the COVID-19 regulations. Johnson was fined by the police last week for attending a birthday party thrown in his honor in June 2020, when people from different households were not allowed to meet indoors. Opponents have called for Johnson to resign, accusing him of misleading Parliament after he told lawmakers last year that all rules were followed in Downing Street, the Prime Minister's official residence and workplace, during the pandemic. That reporting from Reuters. Today was the first time that, since he was fined, he faced members of Parliament in person, and he again apologized to them.
Let me begin in all humility by saying that on the 12th of April, I received a fixed penalty notice relating to an event in Downing Street on the 19th of June, 2020. I paid the fine immediately, and I offered the British people a full apology. And I take this opportunity on the first available sitting day to repeat my wholehearted apology to the House. As soon as I received the notice, I acknowledged the hurt and the anger. And I said that people had a right to expect better of their Prime Minister. And I repeat that, Mr. Speaker, again in the House now. Let me also say, not by way of mitigation or excuse, but purely because it explains my previous words in this House, that it did not occur to me then or subsequently that a gathering in the Cabinet room just before a vital meeting on COVID strategy could amount to a breach of the rules. I repeat, that was my mistake, and I apologise for it unreservedly. I respect the outcome of the police investigation, which is still underway, and I can only say that I will respect their decision-making and always take the appropriate steps. And as the House will know, I have already taken significant steps to change the way things work in Number 10.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, leader of the Conservative Party in the House of Commons in London. Keir Starmer is the opposition leader in Great Britain. He heads the Labour Party. He said today, again, an apology from the Prime Minister, not enough.
The Prime Minister knows what he is. And so he drags everyone else down with him. The more people debase themselves, parroting his absurd defences, the more the public will believe all politicians are the same, all as bad as each other, and that suits this Prime Minister just fine. Some members opposite seem oblivious to the Prime Minister's game. Some know what he's up to, but are too weak to act. But others are gleefully playing the part the Prime Minister cast for them. A minister on the radio this morning saying, It's the same as a speeding ticket. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's not. Yeah. No one has ever broken down in tears because they couldn't drive faster than 20 miles an hour outside a school. Don't insult the public with this nonsense. But, Mr. Speaker, as it happens, the last minister who got a speeding ticket and then lied about it ended up in prison, and I know because I prosecuted him.
Keir Starmer, leader of Great Britain's Labour Party in the House of Commons in London. During today's session, one member of the Prime Minister's own party did call for the Prime Minister to step down, Conservative MP Mark Harper.
Speaker, I strongly support the government's actions in standing up to Putin's aggression and helping Ukraine defend itself and our values. And it's exactly at times like this that our country needs a Prime Minister who exemplifies those values. I regret to say that we have a Prime Minister who broke the laws that he told the country they had to follow, hasn't been straightforward about it, and is now going to ask the men and the decent men and women on these benches to defend what I think is indefensible. I'm very sorry to have to say this, but I no longer think he is worthy of the great office that he holds.
Well, I must say to my right honourable friend, I know the care and the sincerity with which he weighs his words, and I bitterly regret what has happened. I bitterly regret the event in Downing Street, as I have said. But I do believe that it is the job of this government to get on with the priorities of the British people, and that is what we're going to do.
Tom Mateig is a staff writer for The Atlantic, and he joins us from London with more on British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Thank you for being with us. Bottom line from this Partygate scandal, will Boris Johnson stay in office? And if so, how much damage has he suffered?
Well, you've asked the million-dollar question, will he survive? At the moment, it looks like he will. He's certainly in a stronger position than he was just a month or two ago, just before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, when it looked very much like he was on his last legs, this scandal, the drip-drip revelations about parties that had happened in 10 Downing Street during various lockdowns that he initiated. Seem to have cost him the premiership. But we're here today and the revelations are back. He's had a fine from the police for attending a gathering to celebrate his birthday during one of the lockdowns when this was not allowed. And yet he seems to have weathered the storm, partly because of his handling of the crisis in Ukraine has been widely considered quite good. Britain has been in the lead in providing heavy armor weapons to Ukraine. He's built up a very good relationship with President Zelensky. So his position has changed quite dramatically. But the second part of your question, you know, how much has this damaged him? Now, that is something we're going to see play out over the next months and years before the next election. Right now, the polling suggested it has damaged him really quite significantly and perhaps sort of irreversibly, in that people's opinion of him has shifted. And among those people that were crucial to his victory in 2019, those kind of lower middle class, working class voters who had switched from the Labour Party to Boris Johnson to get Brexit over the line, to back him, and now they're absolutely furious with him.
Has the Prime Minister's tone changed at all over the couple of weeks? He was quite defiant when this first came out.
So Boris Johnson's reaction to these revelations has chopped and changed over the months, from being quite defiant at first and swatting them away or attempting to swat them away, until he was forced really by the scale of the revelations to start changing his response being quite apologetic, but insisting that he hadn't gone to any of these parties, to then sort of being very down and almost shaken, at one point looking quite teary as he apologised before the Ukrainian war began and things changed quite considerably, right the way up to now, where his position is one of is a sort of mix. It's one of apology, being quite apologetic about any offence caused and being quite a sort of hangdog expression, but also really being quite defiant. Fundamentally, there is a kind of steel here, and he is saying, there is no way I'm leaving. There's no way I'm being forced from office unless I'm absolutely dragged kicking and screaming.
We're talking with Tom Matteig from The Atlantic in London. I read an article, it was in The Guardian, that said that the ministerial code in Great Britain says that the punishment for misleading Parliament is resignation, but the Prime Minister is the only person who can enforce the code. So under the rules, can anyone force him out, or must there be a resignation for him to leave?
Yeah, I mean, the British system is is famously an unwritten constitution. Now, there are lots of things about the British Constitution that's written down, so it's slightly misleading, but it's not brought together in one single document like you have in the United States. Now, the great sort of strength of the British system is that it is extremely adaptable, and it adapts to the circumstances that it faces and has done so pretty well over the years. It is such a document that can give you Prime Minister like Winston Churchill in a moment of crisis without an election, but it can also provide situations like this where there isn't really a clear guide that's sort of written down. Now, there is this thing, you're right, called the Ministerial Code, but it's not a constitutional document. It's a kind of set of rules that have been drawn up to govern the behaviour of ministers and the Prime Minister. But it's really it's effectively a set of norms of behaviour, how people are expected to behave. And it has become something more like a kind of, it has a constitutional power, but not in the same way as in the US. Now, the thing with it is, as well, it's quite hard to enforce, partly because of what you've said, that the Prime Minister in the end is responsible for enforcing this. He is the sort of chief minister of Her Majesty's government. He is his power resides not in some direct election or some constitutional clause that gives him the power. It rests on his ability to manage a majority in the House of Commons. That is the fundamental principle of the British Constitution. It is, can you command a majority in the House of Commons? Now, and you do that through elections. And he has a majority of 80 in the House of Commons. It's a big majority. It's a working majority that he got in 2019, which means he is, or he should be, untouchable in large part. The biggest check is political, not constitutional. And the political check on his power is those MPs, is the Conservative Party itself, the one that is the biggest party. And now they have the power to remove him. They could remove him tomorrow if they wanted. If they just removed their support for him, they could just pick anybody within their ranks, and that new person would have, as long as they could command that majority, that they have the confidence of the party, then they would have the confidence of the House of Commons. And if you have a majority in Britain, you can pretty much do anything. And the second reason why the ministerial code, as you explained it, is quite difficult, is that it talks about willingly misleading Parliament. You know, so you have to prove not that just that he lied, you know, but he lied on purpose. You know, now Johnson claims, well, I didn't know that what I was doing, you know, turning up to a meeting and finding that people were singing happy birthday to me for 10 minutes in a room inside Downing Street. I didn't realize that was breaking the law. So when I was asked did I break the rules? I replied in good faith that I didn't. So we can sort of dismiss that and say, well, that's nonsense, or you can believe him as well. But ultimately, that's a question of judgment. It's not a question of fact.
Tom Matteig is a staff writer with The Atlantic, joining us from London. You can follow his work on Twitter at Tom Matteig and at theatlantic.com. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And later this week, the Parliament in Britain does plan to vote on whether to form a special parliamentary investigation into these allegations that have now been fined by the police against the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. And you can find all of C-SPAN's coverage of the British House of Commons at our website, cspan.org. And now to Russia's war in Ukraine. This from the Financial Times. Russia said it had begun a new phase of its invasion of Ukraine on Tuesday, as officials in the eastern border region of Donbass urged civilians to flee a renewed offensive. Sergei Lavrov, Russia's foreign minister, gave an interview to the India Today TV channel, first Russian confirmation that it had begun a new offensive to capture the Donbass after partially regrouping its forces and appointing a new field commander for the invasion. Here's a bit of that interview.
Operation in the east of Ukraine is aimed, as was announced from the very beginning, to fully liberate the Donetsk and Lugansk republics. And this operation will continue. It is beginning, another stage of this operation is beginning. And I'm sure this will be a very important moment of this entire special operation.
The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, his interview with India Today ran an hour, during which time he repeated Russian President Vladimir Putin's claims that the invasion of Ukraine, or in their words, special military operation, was due to U.S. policy and NATO military expansion eastward. Lavrov also suggesting Russia is giving up on the not acknowledged initial goal of replacing the Ukrainian government in Kyiv. They did send forces to try to capture the capital. Lavrov saying Russia was not up for regime change in Ukraine and wanted Ukrainians themselves to decide how they want to live. Lavrov also dismissing any speculation that Russia would use tactical nuclear weapons on the battlefield. More from the interview.
We were really encouraged when President Biden was inaugurated 5 days after his inauguration, and we have repeated this offer. He first agreed to extend the START treaty without any preconditions, which the Trump administration was not ready to do. And in June 2021, when they met with President Putin in Geneva, they issued this declaration. On our initiative, this declaration was issued. After the Americans and the Russians said that there must be no nuclear war, don't even think about it, we started to promote the same commitment in the context of the P5. Not the United States, not UK, not France, Russia. And eventually, earlier this year, in January this year, the P5, at the level of the presidents and heads of government, issued the statement which we initiated and which we were pushing through for all these years.
So nuclear is off the table, only last resort.
This statement, both the Russian-American statement and the P5 summit statement, were issued on the strong insistence of the Russian Federation.
The Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, part of his interview with the TV channel India Today. P5 referring to the United Nations Security Council, 5 permanent members: Russia, United States, United Kingdom, China, and France. At the Pentagon in Washington, Press Secretary John Kirby saying the Defense Department is monitoring the nuclear threat every day, given Russian President Putin's statements before and since the invasion of Ukraine.
Official earlier this morning talked about the notion that the department did not see anything imminent. I think that was the official's words, in terms of concerns about Russia's nuclear weapons. Could you clarify a little bit more what this official was talking about? In other words, do you Do you still have any concerns about Putin's threats about nuclear weapons, or is it off the table? And in your mind, in the department's mind, is the secretary continuing to get briefed on the status of Russia's nuclear weapons? How much of a focus is this for him as he continues to get briefings overall on the situation?
The secretary's routinely kept abreast of threats in the nuclear realm, and that includes a regular interchange with the U.S. Strategic Command commander, Admiral Richard. It is something that we monitor virtually every day, particularly in light of the escalatory rhetoric that Mr. Putin voiced at the early days of this war. I would just tell you, without getting into too much classified information, that, again, we monitor this every day. We have seen no reason to change our strategic deterrent posture, and we're comfortable, remain comfortable, that we have the ability, if required, to defend the homeland, our allies, and our partners with the current strategic deterrent posture that we have in place. But it is not something that we ever take for granted. Even before Mr. Putin decided to invade Ukraine, it's the kind of thing that we're constantly monitoring. I mean, that is
the secretary's monitoring of the Russia situation has perhaps, I don't know, stepped up, increased since the invasion and Putin's rhetoric?
I think clearly we took note of what Mr. Putin said in the early days of this invasion. I think it's also important to add that there hasn't been a lot more of that rhetoric following that initial salvo in the early days. But yes, look, in light of what's going on in Ukraine, and certainly in light of the early rhetoric, we are actively monitoring every single day. And even today, the secretary remains comfortable that we have an appropriate strategic deterrent posture in place, and there's no need to make any changes to it.
Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby with reporters in the Pentagon briefing room. AFP reports that Russia is also renewing its demands that Ukrainian fighters holding out at the steel plant in the port city of Mariupol surrender if they want to live. Russian Defense Ministry putting out a statement saying, "We once again call on the Kyiv authorities to show reason and give the corresponding orders to fighters to cease their senseless resistance. But understanding that they will not get such instructions and orders from the Kyiv authorities, we call on the fighters to voluntarily take this decision and to lay down their arms. All who lay down their arms are guaranteed the preservation of life." Well, that demand and that time limit did pass, Ukrainians ignoring it once again and continuing to fight on. The U.S. Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. today asked what his branch of service has learned from observing the fighting in Ukraine so far.
The war in Ukraine is revealing much about Russian capability. So what lessons are you taking from what you are seeing in terms of the Russian invasion in Ukraine? Are there cautionary tales from Russia's example that you're taking into account in Air Force planning?
We're all trying to learn from that. That process isn't over. The lack of professionalism, I'll put it that way, the Russian military came as a little bit of a surprise to a lot of us. The fierce resistance and the professionalism of the Ukrainian people is also exceeded what we might have expected. But when you look at the specifics of the operation, the inability of the Russians to get air superiority and to totally control the air is very interesting. And how that's hampered their ability to do ground operations. So it kind of reinforces the message that you need to control the air. Another thing that's very interesting, though, is that the reason they didn't do that in part was the ground-based air defense systems that the Ukrainians possessed and how effective they were perceived to be against the Russians. And the ability of the Ukrainians to keep them operating over time also. There are a number of other things associated with, on the land side, you know, the effectiveness of what was a traditional mechanized force and how it could operate successfully. That's not over. They're in a very different type of terrain where they're operating now, and we may see some different results there. But the effectiveness of the weapons that we supplied, like Stinger and Javelin, I think those of us who spend pay attention to this sort of thing probably aren't surprised by that too much, but it's obviously become clear that those were very capable and effective weapons against the Russian force in this case. And there are a lot of other things that, as we get into this, we'll get to understand more about the battle management, command and control side of things in particular. Or I think the Russians had great difficulty controlling their force.
Right. Has the Ukraine crisis shown that point-winged fighters aren't actually vital to controlling an airspace? Do you think the service should instead cut fighters and focus more on short-range air defense or drones, something like that?
We're not ready to walk away from some form of tactical aircraft, and we're not quite ready to fully embrace drones operating on their own. In my Next Generation Air Dominance operational imperative, I am including unmanned, uncrewed combat aircraft.
Right.
So I think based on the Skyberg program the Air Force has conducted, the ACE program that DARPA has conducted, the Loyal Wingman program the Australians are doing, there's enough evidence now that says that we can move forward and get to the first generation of uncrewed combat aircraft that work under human control in a formation of some size with a manned aircraft as the controlling node. So I think we're ready to move forward on that. There's still no doubt risk in that, so we have a lot more to learn. But as was indicated by the operation, and as I said earlier, control of the air still matters. It matters a great deal. It basically can deny people the opportunity to move on the ground effectively. That's the point of it. And so that's not something we would walk away from. But you have to do it well. You have to take into account the various types of defenses that you're going to face. And it's again, my Cold War experience where we would build a generation of equipment with some level of capability, and then they would build something a little better, and we would build something a little better. We're back into a race for technological superiority and military capability, and we just haven't had that experience for a long time. But that's where we are now, and we have got to be aggressive about it.
Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall at the National Press Club, questioned by Press Club President Jen Judson, reporter with Defense News. Pentagon is in the middle of sending weapons from the latest $800 million package that President Biden approved last week. It includes howitzer artillery. The White House says that President Biden spoke with European allies today about the war, and there will be more military support coming. NBC News quoting five U.S. officials familiar with the matter, not named, that the administration expected to announce another substantial security assistance package for Ukraine this week, and that it would be about the same size as that $800 million military aid package announced last week. From UPI, Vice President Kamala Harris announced the U.S. commitment to not conduct anti-satellite missile tests, making it the first country to institute the self-imposed ban against the destruction of orbitals and that jeopardize the long-term sustainability of space. Harris announced the ban Monday night before soldiers at the Vandenberg Space Force Base, after having toured it earlier in the day as the first presidential visit to the base near Santa Barbara, California, of the Biden administration. Here's part of what the vice president said. She refers to Russia's recent test.
I am pleased to announce that as of today, the United States commits not to conduct destructive, direct ascent, anti-satellite missile testing. Simply put, these tests are dangerous, and we will not conduct them. We are the first nation to make such a commitment. And today, on behalf of the United States of America, I call on all nations to join us. Whether a nation is spacefaring or not, we believe this will benefit everyone, just as space benefits everyone. In the days and months ahead, we will work with other nations to establish this as a new international norm for responsible behavior in space. And there is a direct connection between such a norm and the daily life of the American people. If a satellite was taken out by debris, it could affect the daily weather forecast, GPS driving directions, and even your favorite television station. Critical infrastructure, like wind turbines that power our homes, well, they rely on satellites for connectivity. Satellites help us track the climate crisis. They enable our commercial activities, and they help us protect our troops and our people. All of this is threatened by the debris created by these reckless tests. These tests also threaten the lives of astronauts in the International Space Station. In fact, I spoke earlier this month with Mark Vanderhei, who just returned from 355 days in space on the space station, an American record. While he was in space, Russia conducted its anti-satellite missile test. He had to shelter in an escape capsule in case the space station was hit by debris. Russia's action was a threat not just to his life, but also to those of Russian cosmonauts.
Vice President Kamala Harris in Santa Barbara, California at Vandenberg Space Force Base. That was from Monday night. Four countries have conducted anti-satellite missile tests in history, rocket fired with the intent of destroying an orbiting satellite: U.S., China, Russia, and India. And now the U.S., the first to say it's not going to do that anymore. From the Washington Post, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen will boycott several meetings of the powerful group of 20 nations this week to protest Russia's invasion of Ukraine, with a conference in Washington emerging as a key test for world leaders who have condemned the war. Yellen will attend the opening session of the G20 finance ministers meeting Wednesday to show support for Ukraine's finance minister, who's flown in from Kyiv for the conference, but will skip other sessions over Russia's presence. That according to an official from the Treasury Department. Today, Secretary Yellen hosting a virtual meeting with the heads of the IMF, World Bank, and ministers representing the G7 and G20 countries, discussing food insecurity and the effect of the war in Ukraine.
Even before the war, over 800 million people were suffering from chronic food insecurity. That's 10% of the global population, and more than the populations of our panelists, five home countries combined. Poor nutrition and food insecurity have serious implications for economic well-being, social and political stability. The war has made an already dire situation worse. Price and supply shocks are already materializing, adding to global inflationary pressures, creating risks to external balances, and undermining the recovery from the pandemic. I want to be clear, Russia's actions are responsible for this. But the United States is urgently working with our partners and allies to help mitigate the effects of Russia's reckless war on the world's most vulnerable. Let there be no doubt, even as we continue escalating our sanctions and other economic measures against Russia, we reiterate our commitment to authorizing essential humanitarian and related activities that benefit people around the world, ensuring the availability of basic foodstuffs and agricultural commodities.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, a virtual meeting on global food security hosted by the Treasury Department. Today, the World Bank lowered its global growth forecast for 2022 from 4.1% to 3.2%, citing higher food and oil costs due to Western nations' sanctions on Russia. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast, wherever you get your podcasts, and on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app. A few other headlines: a press release from Governor Doug Ducey, Republican from Arizona. He said he and 25 other governors today launched the American Governors Border Strike Force, a partnership, he writes, to do what the federal government won't, secure the southern border. He said the American Governor Strike Force, announced today by Governor Ducey and Governor Greg Abbott of Texas, comes a day after a report by the U.S. Customs and Border Protection that disclosed migrant crossings along the U.S.-Mexico border are at the highest level in two decades. And the Biden administration launching a $6 billion effort to save nuclear power plants at risk of closing, citing the need to continue nuclear energy as a carbon-free source of power that helps to combat climate change. That from the Associated Press, which got a notice about what the program will be ahead of its public release, a certification and bidding process opening Tuesday. Ride-sharing apps Uber and Lyft saying today that passengers no longer required to wear masks while riding in their vehicles. This comes after a federal judge on Monday struck down the federal government's mask mandate for airplanes and public transit, trains and buses, saying the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention did not have the authority to impose that mask mandate. Many airlines then dropped their requirement. So did a number of public transit agencies, Washington, D.C. Metro Rail and Metro Bus among them. But some others, like the New York City subway and Chicago's O'Hare International Airport, will continue, they say, to require masks, as will Air Force One. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki speaking to reporters on the plane as President Biden flew to New Hampshire today.
On the mask mandate, why is the DOJ not appealing that? And by not, does the administration risk taking away some of your options for the future, especially if there's some new variants?
Things happened when we got on the plane. I don't think they've made any announcement at this point in time. So, as we've said, agencies are reviewing next steps, including the Department of Justice. Traditionally, following court decision, that can take a couple of days. We have said from the start that our COVID response should be guided by the science and data and by experts. And just as a reminder, when we had made this announcement, the CDC said it needed 15 days to assess the impacts of an uptick in cases on hospitalizations, deaths, and hospital capacity. We still feel, that is entirely reasonable based on the latest science. And public health decisions shouldn't be made by the courts. They should be made by public health experts. I'm not going to get ahead of the Department of Justice. We'll let them make any decisions or announcements. But
so they might still appeal, is what you're saying.
It typically takes a couple of days to review and make an assessment.
If you don't appeal, do you run the risk of sending the message that all CDC mandates are optional?
I'm not going to prejudge the Department of Justice and how they make considerations or assessments about whether or not they're going to appeal. We obviously feel confident in our authorities here, given we put the mask mandate in place and asked for 15 additional days to evaluate data based on public health information.
Was the administration unprepared for this ruling, given that you're not sure what you're going to do next? And also, does the confusion around the mask mandate undercut the administration's ability to kind of give people guidance on what is actually the right thing to do at this point?
I would dispute the notion that people are confused. We are here to alleviate their confusion, right? So the CDC continues to advise and recommend masks on airplanes. We're abiding by the CDC recommendations, the president is, and we would advise all Americans to do that. This was a ruling by the court. We obviously didn't have advance notice of it, and it typically takes a couple of days to assess next steps in these cases.
The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki taking reporters' questions on Air Force One. The president flying to New Hampshire as he toured the port of New Hampshire. Reporters there asking them about the mask mandate.
Mr. President, should people continue to wear masks on planes?
That's up to them.
Are you going to like to appeal the ruling or the ruling that the judge made striking down the mandate?
I haven't spoken to the CDC yet. Thank you. All right.
President Biden in New Hampshire. Dr. Jerome Adams was Surgeon General in the Donald Trump administration. He tweeted today, "Remind me which Schoolhouse Rock explains to kids how a single unelected judge has the power to endanger their lives in public settings. I'm just a judge, and I'm hurting you because I've got a grudge." Adams went on with his tweets, "The argument is not if the judge could do it. The argument is whether or not the judge should have done it after taking into account all the variables and implications of the decision." Well, Air Force One, the trip to New Hampshire, President Biden was there to talk about infrastructure at the Port Authority, investments in ports and waterways, and how this helps improve supply chains. It's the latest in trips he's made to states to highlight the $1.2 trillion infrastructure law that he signed last year. He talked today about dredging the harbor, the shipping channel and basin, and also $45 million to fix bridges in New Hampshire in the coming year, and also planned investments to expand access to broadband.
We're making historic investments in fixing these bridges. This year alone, we're delivering $45 million to fix your bridges here in New Hampshire. This year alone. The last fellow had this job kept talking about infrastructure week for 4 years. We not only took your infrastructure, we have an infrastructure decade. This is going on. $1.2 billion. You know, we used to have the finest infrastructure in the world. We now rank number 13 in the quality of our infrastructure. China's ahead of us. So many other countries have moved. Folks, this matters. It matters our safety, our security, our health, and a whole range of other. Not only that, about 700 miles of highway in New Hampshire are in poor condition. It's estimated that the driving on those roads, those 700 miles, roughly 700 miles, that need repairs cost New Hampshire drivers at least an average of $476 a year extra in gas and repairs and longer commute times. That's a $476 hidden tax on New Hampshire drivers. Look, thanks to the infrastructure law, we're making the most significant investment in modernizing our roads and bridges since the interstate highway system was built with Eisenhower. We're also going to start to replace the 100%, all 100% of lead water pipes and service lines going into our homes and our schools.
President Biden today in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. On Wall Street, the Dow up 499, NASDAQ up 287, S&P up 70. If Republicans in the U.S. House regain a majority after the midterm elections this November, a reform idea that has just been floated in news reports requiring House Democrats to follow the same committee leader term limits that House Republicans now have in their rules, 3 2-year terms. Joining us now with more on this is Mike Lilla, senior staff writer with The Hill. Thanks for being here. Where did this come from? Why are House Republicans talking about this?
Well, that's a great question. Thanks for having me, Michael. The short version is that, you know, if you remember last year, Democrats, Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats took a remarkable step of removing two controversial Republican lawmakers, Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia and Paul Gosar of Arizona, from their committee seats. And this was seen by Republicans as an encroachment on the powers of the minority. At the start of each Congress, each new Congress, each party establishes a set of internal rules. And as part of those rules, they are given autonomy over who they get to pick for their committees. And that has dictated how the House has governed itself for many, many years. And this was seen as a breach of protocol, if you ask the Republicans. And so this is seen as a form of retaliation against the Democrats for what thought was overstepping and abusing their powers by removing Green and Gosar from the committee. So I should mention that the Republican leaders are also threatening to remove some Democrats from the committees if they take the House, but the term limits could be seen as an extension of that retaliation.
So just in terms of the rules, House Republicans with a majority could do this.
They could do this, that's for sure, yes. There are several, various sets of that govern how the House functions. Some are established by each party separately, and that has included how the committees are seated and how the committees are run, including the term limits. And then there's one big rules package that it will be passed next January that governs the entire chamber. And that is where Republican leaders right now, they're bullish, as you mentioned, they're bullish about their chances of flipping the House. And they could pass that big rules package governing everybody without a single Democratic vote, assuming that they have the majority. They would write the legislation, they would bring it to the floor, and because the House only needs a simple majority to pass anything, they could push the rules package through with the term limits that would then apply to Democrats and Republicans alike.
What's been the reaction from the House Democrats?
Well, you've seen a mixed, that's another great question. And the answer is it's mixed, because the term limit idea has always been a little bit controversial within both parties, actually, but especially within the Democratic Party. And that's because they don't have term limits. And that has created a situation where a handful of lawmakers have been sitting at the top of these committees, in some cases, for almost two decades. And so there's this consolidation of power at the top of some of these committees. And there is a newer group, a younger group of lawmakers who's kind of eager to climb the ranks of power. And they would like to the opportunity to do so. And by establishing term limits at the top of committees, they would have greater opportunities to rise through the ranks. And so they are, in fact, welcoming this idea that the Republicans might establish the term limits that Democratic leaders have refused to do over the course of many years. The flip side of that is that there are also, a number of powerful Democrats, both those who are in these seats right now and those who are allies of the people in those seats right now, who are opposed to this. And a really influential group in this debate is the Congressional Black Caucus, because they have a number of lawmakers who are extremely senior. They've been around for a long time, and they are at the top of a lot of these committees. And they, whenever we have this debate, they say, we've been waiting around for years to get these committee seats, and now you're going to change the rules and pull the rug out from under us. And that is inherently unfair. So their argument is both that you can't change the rules midstream, and they are touting this idea that, veterans have been around for a while, and by definition, they have the most experience in governing. And so they should be the ones who are running the committees because they've got that experience.
Interesting line in your article that former President Donald Trump, presumably still the Republican Party leader, may not be on board with this.
That's right. The interesting thing is that it is a bipartisan debate. There is contention on both sides of the aisle. And the reason is, going back to 2018, when Pelosi and the Democrats won control of the House, there were a number of Republicans who retired, a number of incumbent, powerful veteran Republicans who left Congress. And the reason for that wave in many cases was that they had their term limits at the top of committees was about to expire. And that angered Trump, who said, well, why would you have term limits that would push good lawmakers to retire and threaten the majority, my Republican majority? Now I can't push anything through the House. So again, there's an argument on both sides of the aisle about whether or not this is a good idea. And for the Republicans who do have term limits, there is an incentive or a disincentive for veteran lawmakers to remain in Congress, because once you've had a gavel for 6 years, why would you want to go back to being a backbencher? Some of them just choose to retire, and that was Trump's point, and that's why he tried to press GOP leaders to overturn their own term limit rule. They talked about it, they didn't do it, but now they're talking about it again. So we'll just have to see how it plays out in January. But again, good arguments on both sides of this debate.
Mike Lillis is a senior staff writer with The Hill. Find his articles at thehill.com. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Anytime.
A new poll from Politico and Morning Consult out today, finding voters split evenly on the generic congressional ballot question. 43% of voters saying they would most likely vote for the Democratic candidate this year. 42% would likely vote for the Republican. The rest say they have no opinion or don't know yet. The four-member crew from the first-ever privately funded and operated mission to the International Space Station will be heading home soon. Today, they held a farewell ceremony. You're going to hear the crew commander, a former NASA astronaut, Michael Lopez Alegria, who's an employee of Axiom Space, the company running the mission. And you're also going to hear from one of the other crew members. There are three more, the paying customers, Larry Connor.
This really begins a new era of human spaceflight, where people other than just government astronauts, who are obviously very professionally trained and prepared, can come up with a little bit less training but still able to function in this very unique and sometimes challenging environment. And I think that is sort of a first step toward a real democratization of this experience. It's going to take a while, because the prices obviously are quite high now. But we think that in the future, this will be something that we can share with more and more part of humanity, and will make humankind all the better for it. Let me pass it over to Larry.
First, thanks to Crew 3. The fact is, without their help, support, coaching, mentorship, there's absolutely no way we would have been able to accomplish this wide range of experiments over the last 8 days. It was, as Mike said, an aggressive schedule. Fortunately, we were able to accomplish our objectives, and hopefully it'll lead to some great groundbreaking research. Also, too, we conducted as a team over 15 educational outreach to youth all across the world, not just in the United States. So hopefully that'll make a positive impact on the next generation. And if you ask me, well, what's the experience been like? Exhilarating and unique. Lastly, thanks to NASA, all the folks at Huntsville for supporting us, because again, without their key involvement, coaching, direction, this would not be possible.
Larry Connor, and before that, Michael Lopez Alegria on the International Space Station. Lopez Alegria is a former NASA astronaut and is commander of this first privately funded, privately operated mission to the ISS. Larry Connor and the other two crew members, who are not the former astronauts, according to space.com, reportedly paid $55 million to go on the trip, which has lasted 12 days. And also space.com saying that AX1 will be just the beginning for Axiom Space if all goes according to plan. The company has booked several other crewed missions to the space station with SpaceX. And beginning in late 2024, Axiom plans to launch several modules to the ISS. These modules will eventually detach, becoming an independent private space station in Earth orbit. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. You can get more Washington top stories sent to you each day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter. Go to c-span.org/connect to sign up. And I hope you have a good night.